Hello, and welcome back to The Civic Flame, a podcast where we take a deep dive into the U.S. Constitution and think about how it is and is not working today. Now that we've finished our look at the seven articles of the U.S. Constitution, and hopefully you've been keeping up with those, we're going to get into the amendments. Now, the amendments, as I've mentioned before, are 27 or 28 additions. Amendments are changes. There are things we add to the Constitution that either put new things in there or take some things out of there or teach us how to reinterpret what's supposed to be in there. And this leaves us with some interesting questions about what is going on in there. One of my personal fun facts about the U.S. Constitution is that right out of the gate, we get a Bill of Rights. That is 10 amendments to the Constitution from very, very quickly. The Constitution is created from very, very quickly after the Constitution is created, we already have those changes. So now that we've finished up with the Constitution itself, we are going to hit that first 10 amendments, that Bill of Rights, and we'll for sure hit the 14th Amendment, and we'll get into other areas as they come up. But we've got a good news, bad news situation here. The good news is that the readers of my book liked it, and they suggested some helpful and very extensive revisions in a couple of areas. The bad news is those revisions are due on the 1st of June. This means that my free time, including my podcast time, is going to get pretty tight soon. So we're going to roll with it and see how it goes and keep doing the podcast until time says we can't do that very much anymore. But for now, we'll deal with the First Amendment to the Constitution and see how that goes. One of the most litigated things in U.S. history is probably the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Why? Because it has five key freedoms in there. The First Amendment says, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people to peaceably assemble, and to petition the government for a redress of grievances." Despite it being so short, it means a lot. So let's take it clause by clause. And remember, a clause is a section. First of all, Congress shall make no law. Interestingly, this was originally taken to mean that the Bill of Rights only applied to the federal government. In a case in 1833 called Barron v. Baltimore, the Supreme Court said this literally meant Congress, as in the federal government. So until the 14th Amendment was passed after the Civil War, it meant that federal Congress could not restrict your liberties. Essentially, the president and Congress couldn't restrict your free speech, but your state could. This led to a lot of problems, which is why the 14th Amendment includes in it a clause that says you are citizens of your state and the federal government. The 14th Amendment creates also this doctrine of selective incorporation. For those of you hoping to take the LSATs and get into law school, get this one tattooed on your arm somewhere, because you're going to need to know what it means. But it means that some rights are incorporated or worked together from the Bill of Rights to the states. Political rights like citizenship, speech, due process, these tend to be the most incorporated. But there are a lot of questions about which ones, to what extent, whose responsibility it is to pay for it, and so on. So these cases continue to be litigated. Beyond that, we also want to remember that these aren't actually rights, which require the government to do something. They are liberties, which means the government needs to keep out. These are freedoms from the government. And that is a little bit different. But we'll start with the freedom of religion part. Congress shall make no law establishing a religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now, this is one we seem to be getting wrong a lot lately. There has been a decided and deliberate political movement to give power to Christianity, and I'm saying that in air quotes because this is not real Christianity. This is Christianity as a political movement, because religious people, including faithful Christians that I know, are very much against the government having power over their religion. And saying the religion has certain power in politics means sooner or later the state is going to have control of what your religion says. So if you look up Christian identity movements, you'll see that these are extremist organizations that are not Christian. but used the language and name of Christianity to get a pass from scrutiny. They write things like the Seven Mountain Mandate, which you can look up and read. You don't just have to take my word for it. That explains why their specific ideology should have control of the culture, education, the family, the economy, the government, etc., and in particular, over anybody's religion that doesn't agree with theirs. But they very literally take the Lord's name in vain by using the name Christian to hide from any political, legal, or other scrutiny, because they know it works. When people call them out, they say, "Oh, you're persecuting me because I'm a Christian." It's like, no, nobody's feeding you to lions here. We're not persecuting you because you're a Christian. You're not a Christian, and we're not persecuting you. We're simply describing what you're doing. If that makes you sound like a bad person, then your problem is with your actions, not with my definition of what you're doing. So this ends up leaving us with many laws that say things like, religious freedom says I can refuse to do my job, like Kim Davis refusing to grant marriage licenses to gay couples, or pharmacists refusing to dispense birth control, or bakers refusing to bake wedding cakes for people they don't like. The government is meant to be neutral because they cannot establish a religion, meaning they cannot tip the scales to one side or another because this is what guarantees free exercise. If you're really interested in this, there were congressional hearings in the 1960s where members of the clergy from different Christian denominations came in and testified before Congress that they were against the kind of things we see today because they didn't believe you should coerce people's faith by making it a government doctrine, and they didn't believe that they should give the government any power over what their religion says or does. And yet today we see that very vastly changing. But these two clauses are inextricably linked. Free exercise for all exists because, and can only exist when, the government obeys the Establishment Clause. And yet you get cases like the Bremerton, Washington case, and shout out to my brother who lives out that way, where a high school coach was saying a Christian prayer with his team at the 50-yard line. This display of religion on public grounds, in public, is weird, but it's not illegal. And to me, it's weird because anytime anyone feels the need to get a pat on the back for doing this in public, I question their legitimacy and how much they're doing it from faith and how much they're doing it because they want people to know that they're doing it. And I also say that they're forcing the students to participate because there is a power imbalance between coaches and players. It is significant, and there is no way to guarantee that any of these students, most of whom were underage, are able to give their consent voluntarily to what's going on. More than any threat to the U.S. political order in the next decade, you will see and are seeing radical groups using the rhetoric of religion to gain state and political power. This is also true with Christian nationalists. These people are not Christians, nor are they patriots. They are the people who believe a very specific version of Christianity should rule the United States and the world. Most religions, including many Christian religions, don't count to them. Like any other religious supremacy group, they believe that not only their religion, but their version of their religion should have the political power, the economic power, and the power of the state. And like any other extremist religious group, Christian or non-Christian, it becomes a problem for people who get caught up in that system and don't agree with them. And then we get, as if that weren't enough, to the Free Speech Clause. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. This has changed a lot over time. It includes spoken words, but it also includes things like protest signs, t-shirts, and other things that might be considered expressions or speech acts, as the court says. There has been contention in our political system about what this means with regards to hate speech. In a case called Chaplinsky v. New Hampshire in the 1940s, the Supreme Court created a fighting words doctrine, and this says that if there are words that are so incendiary that they would cause normal people to fight, they are not covered by free speech. That has been dramatically narrowed down over time, as you can imagine. The Bill of Rights Institute and the Free Speech Center at Middle Tennessee State University offer some great in-depth resources about this, as does the podcast 5-4. I told one of my French students that Holocaust denial was legal in the United States, and she was really shocked because that kind of thing is illegal in a lot of Europe. Hate speech and the rise of misinformation and disinformation, especially in the age of AI, deepfakes, and revenge porn, bring up a lot of questions about whether and how the government can regulate speech. Typically, the government has used the idea that political speech is the most protected, and that commercial speech is the least protected, and that you can't ban speech based on content. So there are some tests for when and how laws should be applied, but this will continue to be a fight in U.S. society. And this goes into, but isn't exactly the same as, the freedom of press. The freedom of the press has been our most sacred freedom, and it is the lack of this freedom now that is tipping the U.S. from democracy to flawed democracy on the Global Democracy Index. While the U.S. has legally free speech and a legally free press, over 90% of our social and legacy media are owned by the same group of billionaires, many of whom have direct ties to the president and his allies, to politicians in Congress, as well as to that human vomit pile, Jeffrey Epstein. These organizations sometimes explicitly state that they favor the president and their own point of view. Other times it's more subtle. The more we look at it lately, and the more we see members of the Trump administration and his allies knowing and being associated with the Jeffrey Epstein files, the more it starts to look like these people are just using Donald Trump and his popularity to be in positions of government to protect themselves when they knew those files would come out. But the idea with free speech is that you're supposed to counter this hate speech with more speech. But the reason I can say that is that we have free speech laws. The government is not allowed to bar me from what I say. And this is a key thing that people tend to forget about free speech and the First Amendment generally. This very much relates to the government. In terms of who can stop press freedom, there are a lot of questions about editorial content, how much the owners of the media organizations have to say. And in terms of free speech in general, there are also questions about who can be fired for what kind of speech is unacceptable in what places, and so on. So these are very much about government targeting people based on the speech or based on the freedom of the press, and that changes a little bit. So for instance, if you see somebody saying something stupid and someone calls them on it, and then they say, oh, well, I have the freedom of speech. Yeah, sure you do, but that's not what's going on right now. What's going on is that you're not free from the consequences of your speech socially. If someone wants to argue with you and tell you you're wrong or have a problem with you, socially speaking, they can do that. Freedom of speech just means the government can't throw you in prison for it, unless you're doing something like giving out classified information and the government feels like prosecuting you for that. Remember, it's only illegal until you get prosecuted. Wait, no, that's terrible legal advice. Don't listen to that. When it comes to hate speech, this goes much more into questions of how do we stop people from saying things that are going to deliberately lead to fights? And it's unclear. Typically, the idea has been we want to stop hate speech with more speech. This worked hilariously when the Proud Boys hashtag got flooded with pictures of gay men and men in drag. The issue with the press adding more speech is that it breaks up the information sphere so that many people aren't even living in the same reality. The freedom of the press was a pillar of our constitutional order so that it could hold the government accountable. That worked beautifully during the Pentagon Papers, the Watergate scandal, to a lesser extent with the My Lai massacre and the Oliver North scandals, and so on. But because it worked, wealthy people bought up the press, making it legally free, but fiscally controlled by the same few people. If you check out Yahoo Finance, you can actually go and see the majority shareholders in any of the major media companies. It's fascinating. And it's been the hardest part about the last few decades for me because I love the press. I recommend following Dan Rather on social media, though, because he's great at reminding people why the press is still important. But boy, give me a TV show or a movie or a documentary about an intrepid reporter taking it to the system any day, and I'm going to watch it. But the last two freedoms, while they only sometimes make as good a movie as the speech and press cases, include the right to peaceably assemble and the right to petition the government for redress of grievances. The petition power hasn't really come under much scrutiny, but the right to assemble certainly has. It is taken for granted that, for security reasons, you can apply time, place, and manner regulations on how people protest or assemble. But this has been contentious and exploited massively by state, local, and federal governments around the country and often around the world. But when we think about major protests like Resurrection City in D.C. in the late 1960s, where people camped out on the National Mall, or the Occupy Wall Street movement in the early 2000s, you see people in power acting with force to destroy these protests. Why? Because they're very effective. But you also see people around the country today out protesting ICE, protecting their neighbors. So it's important to understand that the scale and role of protest in our democracy cannot be overestimated. A role thought to be so vital to our democracy that it was protected right up there in Amendment 1. And so when you see a bunch of people out protesting in the cold, you can think they're weird. You don't have to wave and honk at them, although you might want to because it's nice. You might think that they're ineffective, and that's okay if that's what you think. But they are out there exercising that First Amendment and making their voice heard and making their protests heard. And that's kind of what this whole First Amendment was all about, to give us the space to obviously, legally, make a little trouble for the government through petitioning them, through assembling so we could hold up our signs and tell them we don't like them, through the press, through speech, and to keep them off our back about our religion and our faith. So as we get into the next couple of amendments, we'll take a think about all of the ways these liberties from the government are meant to bind the government to a very specific role of limited powers that has maybe effect on our daily lives in terms of policy, but certainly none in terms of conscience. Okay, that was your quick and dirty look at the First Amendment. At the end of the day, you could do at least one whole college semester on each of these clauses. I've done multiple college semesters just on the free speech clause. But these are starting points. Next week, we're going to look at both the Second and Third Amendment together. Or as I like to think of it, we're going to look at controversial and not controversial all on the same day. Then we'll hit 4 through 8 and talk about due process. I love talking about due process. Until then, like, share, and subscribe. Follow us on Substack, Blue Sky, and Instagram at Dr. Fun Sponge. Stay warm out there and keep the civic flame burning bright. The Civic Flame is a product of the Dr. Fun Sponge Media Group with writer Amber Veo and sound producer Matthew Munyon. Thanks for listening.